This is the EWN Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to Empowering Motherhood Radio. I'm Tara Darlington and I'm Light the Journey for you. Now, we're talking today with an amazing woman who really has spent her quite a long time working with women and children and families, especially around trauma and abuse. So it's quite a heavy topic in some ways, and I want to cover quite a lot today. So Mary Jo McVeigh is from Ireland, and she started working with children who experienced abuse and trauma more than 25 years ago, and still passionate about it, with quite a lot of amazing things happening to support these people and their family. How are you? Welcome to the show, Mary Jo.
Hello, Tara. I'm good. And yourself?
Yeah, we're very good. So just give us a little bit of an idea of, you know, what led you into working in this particular area of specialty, much needed area of specialty.
Well, when I think about starting social work, my mind travels back to a time when I was about, I'd say, 3-ish or 4-ish. It was certainly an age before I started school, because I was at home with my mother, and I can see myself holding onto her penny tightly, and penny's the word we used for our mother's apron. So I'm holding on tightly to her penny, and I'm looking out from the folds of her skirt at this, what I described then as this alien being, because he was so unkempt and quite dirty. I mean, the dirt was ingrained on his skin, and his odor was quite old. And I was watching my mother tend to him, and I watched her help him wash his hands and then feed him with the same type of tenderness and love she would have looked at her children. And it wasn't until many years later, when somebody asked me the very question you're asking me, that that story came very present in my mind, and I realized that that was probably the beginning of my belief in service to humanity, from watching the beauty of my mother. And I just happened to convert that belief in serving humanity into a profession called social work. Yeah.
Wonderful work. So it's really where it starts. There's so much is ingrained in us from our childhood experiences, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I noticed that particularly because my social work profession has now been on the go like 30 years, I think. Has all been working with women, and I know. I think it must be about 30 years. Women and children who've been oppressed by abuse and violence. So I've done a lot of work over the years in child protection, and in assessment units, and in trauma centres, working with children, and adolescents, and adult survivors of childhood trauma. And it really does leave a lasting imprint in the heart and the let's say the heart and the spirit. How you're brought up and
So what would be, this is a bit of a maybe a broad question, but what would, you know, there's the extreme of the people that you're working with, but then, you know, in our daily life as a society, we're sort of often teetering on the edge of abuse and trauma in some areas, aren't we? When you talk about how it lives in the heart and the being, like, what would your definition of abuse or trauma be in everyday life?
Yeah, I was going to say, if your question's broad, my answer's broad. I am a little bit controversial because I think there's a continuum. And I think there's a continuum of how we treat each other. And certainly on the severe end of the continuum would be what I do in my work. So that's your known child abuse and neglect and trauma. And everybody would go, oh, yeah, that's a clear issue of physical abuse or sexual abuse or emotional abuse. But I think towards the other continuum, how we treat each other, particularly how we treat those members of our society, or i.e. our children. For me, if I was with elders, I would be talking to you about the elder population. And the measure of us as an abusive or a non-abusive society, for example, is how we treat our vulnerable, i.e. our children, and then how we treat those who care for our children, and that happens to be parents, and certainly in my experience, mums. And I know there are, you know, living dads now, and dads who dedicate a lot of their time to children, but generally in society, it's mostly our mums. I think there's a, oh gosh, where do I start? I don't know why the word fear is popping into my head, Tara, but isn't that interesting? I think there is a fear to fully love, love your children. In case you get some kind of societal criticisms or sanctions about way to raise your children, that we must have children who comply and are obedient, and those awful expressions like spare the rod and spare the child or whatever those awful expressions are, I think sometimes in the same mentality, you just have to go into public places and look the way poor parents are harassing their children to sit down, be still, be quiet. The whole energy of childhood is to run around, be noisy, be creative. So I think certainly some of the ordinary, everyday mechanisms of life, we can teeter on some of that stuff, which is not helpful to developing children. And it's quite punitive to parents who want to be more expressive in parenting their children. That's a very broad answer, isn't it?
That is a broad answer, but that's okay, because I wanted to just sort of, you know, you've got one end of you know, really healthy families and relationships, and then you've got the other end of the abuse, and then there's, you know, there still are some things, practices and general beliefs and sort of norms in our society which could change, aren't there, that are teetering on the edge of abuse. And, you know, I think a lot of parents are always wondering what that is, and those sort of questions around, you know, are you loving your child or are you spoiling your child? You know, are you allowing your child freedom and creativity, or are you creating a rod for your own back? You know, so there's just that, a lot of exploration happening around in that center area at the moment, that, you know, there is a teetering over the edge into abuse, sometimes is the norm in society.
Yeah, no, I'm nodding my head away here, which... You know, really
nodding
in agreement. And a couple of people, when I have these broader conversations, sometimes think that I'm being offensive to them. And it's not that I want to cause offense or being offending to anyone, but it's having a clear belief around how to bring the next generation into being and how we hold their humanity. And I'm a believer in holding our children securely. So for me, securely is having the beautiful boundaries. That's about safety. And I've said it to my fellows who are now 21 and 18, and I've always said to them, safety, number one parenting principle, always has been since they've been small. And then the other place I must parent from is a place of trust. Is I need to trust in children's bodies and hearts and spirit, and follow them as they grow. And if sometimes they teeter into unsafe behavior, then my role is to go, no, you know, come back in. That's unsafe for you or others, but still allow that lovely growth to happen. And it's interesting, so therefore I've had many descriptions for my parenting, from permissive. I think that's the polite version. I think permissive is the polite version. And other such descriptions, because I allowed my children to be like that, explore, and to have a voice. I've always allowed them to have a voice around my parenting. And if they felt with anything I was doing, which was inappropriate or abusive, and they would name it, because I think I've got an abusive parent in me. You know, we all have. We're all human.
Yeah.
We're all imperfect. We're all going to hurt each other. That's okay. It's, do you keep rising above that, and you know, try not to be. So I always encourage them to critique my parenting, which is interesting, because I still do. But likewise, then I would to critique their behavior.
You know, yes, that's right. It's a two-way street.
But still acknowledging, but I'm the parent, So I have to be the particularly when they're younger, when you think of how small a baby's body is compared to an adult body. So, of course, I'm physically stronger and emotionally stronger and have to be wiser, like have to hold that wisdom. So I don't drop the authority of my parenting, but I'm not abusive with it. Does that make sense, Tara?
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that boundary is what a lot of people are trying to find.
Yeah. Yes, which is why the second part I was sent to you about society, about how we treat our most vulnerable, the second part is also how we treat those who care for our most vulnerable. So I think we should allow parents more of a voice to go, I tried that, didn't work, tried that, it worked. Mm. Allow them, within the boundaries of keeping the children safe, allow them to themselves as a parent. Like, find their joy, find their identity as a parent while their child finds their identity. Hold their strength, hold their authority while they allow the child to explore and be creative. Society says, no, there's a certain way to do it. You're not going to voice that. The fact, I believe, it's very important that parents are allowed to give voice to discovering themselves as a parent. And it's parenting is not just a practice. And people keep talking about, you know, parenting practices and going to parenting groups, and I'm interested in the identity and how you find that identity of yourself and then in connection to your children. And it's okay to stumble around and find that without having other people be judgmental of you.
I think it's very judgmental because everyone, there's, trying to find what that line is, as I said, of, being, having a lot more emotionally connected and a lot softer emotionally when we need to, but finding that balance with the strength at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I believe it's possible to do both because, again, I know that we live in a dualistic society, and a dualistic society says, well, you're either strong and tough or you're soft. And I'm going, well, why can't you be strong and hold your children firmly and... show this tenderness and this softness and this ability to explore. So if we get out of that dualistic thinking, that can also help.
Yeah, that's right. And children crave, clear boundaries, don't they? So it's also a matter of, creating a clear, loving boundaries, basically, and also allowing a little bit of flexibility. I was talking to someone recently about this. Flexibility is a highly prized, quality in an adult. Yet, some people want to hold the boundary so tight, in order to hold the children in control. So there's nice, firm, loving boundaries, but, the children want to know what is expected of them. At the same time, there needs to be that little bit of flexibility.
Absolutely, and I think they're great twins. So they are consistency and flexibility. They belong together. So give your children a consistent life, but oh my goodness, celebrate the fact that you can be flexible and your children can teach you. There's nothing scary going to happen if you go, okay, maybe I should do this differently. Maybe I'm open to
that's course. Right.
Good parenting has to have the hallmarks of consistency and flexibility. There's just no question. And therefore, that ability to naturally respond. So a responsive, flexible, consistent parent. Oh, it's beautiful. Beautiful recipe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so what are the main things that you've learned out of your work that you've brought into your parenting? So seeing... working with children with a lot of trauma and obviously quite a lot of them with quite extreme experiences, what are the, what are sort of your wisdom that you've taken out of that then you've then taken into your own parenting?
I love that question because I heard my response in my head was, it flowed both ways. Isn't that interesting? So working with children who are traumatized, I think the gifts that they give to me, to give to my children, was that stuff around flexibility, consistency, safety. Again, I know I mentioned that, but working from the ethic of safety in my parenting, because I also think parenting is a very ethical practice.
Yes.
Definitely. And not being frightened to love them. It's gosh, it's almost that simple. Forget the controlling. Love them. I have this catchphrase that goes, control the environment, not the child. Control the environment, not the child. And so, so for example, if you'd come to my house and my two were littlies, you'd have to think that I, you know, lived out of a cardboard box. Because you came into my lounge room, and all there was a television in the corner and the sofas, which had throw-overs on them so you could take them off and wash them, and a coffee table. That was it. Now, I travelled extensively before I had children, so I packed away all my lovely bits and bobs that I got in travelling, and I stored them because I didn't want to spend my children's childhood screaming at them going, don't touch that, don't do that, don't. Mm. And when there's nothing to break in the house, there's no don't. So
yeah, that's right.
That's what I did. I thought, control the environment, Mary Jo, be child-friendly, and then you can follow your children's lead. So that's, I think that stuff of following the principle of love rather than control is what I brought. Mm. And then coming, what my children gave to me to give to children I work with therapeutically is to know what it is like to see a very loved child. And my two children are just so loved. And how, despite, you know, because we've had our few ups and downs, but despite the ups and downs, they know who they are, and they know they're loved. And so I try to bring that into my therapeutic relationships with children so they can experience the beauty of who they are.
Yeah, right. So is that because you're the Wrapped with Angels, I want you to tell us a bit more about that, but that's sort of coming into that real, you know, like you said, the boundary, the safety, the security, the knowing that you're loved, that you're worthy of being wrapped in angels, I guess. Tell us a bit about your Wrapped in Angels program, because I think it's something that people could apply just in their daily life as well to help.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, tell us about that amazing program that you've got.
Now, I really wish you could see the grin on my face because it's my favorite thing to talk about. So, again, let me bring you back to where Wrapped was born. So it wasn't created as a technique. And my profession is a lot of clinical techniques to work with children. Wrapped was the very opposite. It came from something that happened to me in my life when I was going through a very, very difficult time. Mm. And I continue in my conversations with my grandmother, who was a great character in my childhood, who loved me deeply. And going through this difficult time, I remember saying to my grandmother, Granny, can you just send me something? Send me a symbol to know that I'm held and I'm going to get through this. And I asked her for symbols of angels, which is interesting because, ironically, even though I now write about angels, it wasn't something I wrote about or talked about, the iconic religious symbol. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I got through this very difficult time. I was very present to the love of my grandmother, and it was a very clear message was that you are held, Mary Jo, and you are loved, and it's all around you in the physical realm as well as, for me, in the spiritual realm. So I was working with some children at the time who really didn't feel they were loved, well, because they weren't loved. They were in foster care, and they had to leave their family at birth because of the levels of abuse. And I noticed that they had very little to hold on to or pull on to in those moments of doubt and darkness. So I remember saying to this young girl one day, what you need is an angel blanket. And she said to me, in rather colourful language, may I say, was, what's an angel blanket? And I went, well, you're going to have to come back and find out. And then the next session she came back and I said, so let's think about all the stuff in your life that you love and everything that makes you feel safe and happy. And we just pulled down all these ideas. And then we drew them as pictures, and then we cut them out as templates, and we sewed them onto a blanket, and that was the first angel blanket. And lo and behold, 12, 13 years later, I have presented it at international conferences. I'm about to start my doctorate in social work at university, researching the power of these blankets. And I've just finished a year's pilot with victims of crime, children who've been victims of crime. With the blankets. And so it's the physical wrapping themselves in the blanket, but it's also the emotional and spiritual symbols that they wrap themselves in. It just reminds them that despite everything that has happened to them. There is, you know, things out there that will love and protect them and keep them safe. It's an absolute beautiful program, Tara. I'm not even doing it, you know, service speaking like this, because it's hard to talk about it. It's when you experience it that you really notice the power of it. It's hard for me to do it service in words because it's such a beautiful program. And when you watch children, I've also done with adult survivors of trauma, but when you watch them get to the moment where the blanket's created and they wrap it around themselves, there are no words to describe it. It's absolutely beautiful. Yeah, I do love that part of my work.
So, so one of the things that you mentioned is that they, you know, often not having something to hold on to, not having, I guess, a foundation or something, you know, to grasp, to I guess, like when you've had a healthy upbringing, and a very loving upbringing, you've sort of always got a straw to grab onto when things get tough. Mm-hmm. So, is that a part of what you see with these children?
That's exactly right, Tara. Because those of us who have been loved and nurtured, it's not that we take it for granted. That's not what I want to say. But it almost goes into the very core of our being. You know, into our very DNA, and it's like, oh yeah, bang, that's who we are, and you know, we move out from that. In fact, you know, we probably give our parents a hard time, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because we are connected. We can move out, and I think we take those things for granted, and the fact that we're also, I believe, caught in this beautiful web of belonging. So this beautiful web of belonging to family and you know, communities. For Jill and I work with who've been abused, and they often from family, so that's a loss. And even though that family may be the source of abuse, they still grieve the loving part of that family. And then they also lose that entire den of family, and they might have to geographically move from schools, and it's just loss after loss. And if that starts to get ingrained in your DNA when you're an adult, it's like, well, where do you belong, and what do you hold on to when you face difficult times? Because we all face difficult times in our lives, and the thing that get us through difficult times are the love of family and friends and community. What gets us through dangerous times is being connected to our practices, be they cultural practices or spiritual practices. For some, it can even be sporting practices and pastimes. It's all that delicious stuff we're connected to. You pull upon that and go, okay, this is going to get me through this dark time. Well, if you haven't got that, what is there to bring you through difficulty?
Yeah.
So that's a main driver in my work.
Right. Yeah, you can see it with the, you know, in the teenage years. If they're not, you know, they don't want to be over busy. We're all over busy, I guess. But if they're not busy enough, if they haven't got, you know, like if they've got a great sport or hobby that they love, then it really gives them something to, that I guess consistency as well, that we were talking about before, and something to hold on to sort of, you know, pull themselves through that time. I know with my daughter, it was, when she went through a hard time, it was, you know, I was advised, don't let her stop ballet, keep her, you know, she had somewhere to go 3 days a week and something to focus on. And I guess especially with children from poorer families, or if they're being moved around in foster care, they don't really have, you know, they're, like you're saying, they're moving locations. They don't even have their sports team or their, you know, hobby consistent in their life.
Absolutely, Darren. And as well as having the physical activity to absorb your energy, it also gives you a sense of identity and a sense of achievement. So if you do something like a ballet step, or you make something like in a craft class, you've done that. And that can never be taken away from you. And that moment in time where you achieved and you have a sense of self, it's just a precious, precious moment in time. And those moments build up and build up and build up and build up and build up. And we have to be very careful that we don't underestimate the importance of children doing stuff like that. Now, I also think there's a balance between overdoing. I absolutely agree with you. I think far too many of our children will do far too many classes. I'm not talking about classes. And how much stuff they love, love, love doing. And that means making mud pies in the back garden. It's important.
Yeah.
So So what's important to children in doing is important. And we adults have to allow time for children's important doing, not our sense of important in doing. Because from that, you have a sense of self-esteem and you learn skills and all of that's identity building.
And connection with the moment, connection with what you're doing, connection with your community if it's with other people. But even mud pies in the backyard, it's still connection with your environment we grew up backing up onto a reserve, and I can still remember, every stick, every tree, every every stone, you get that, and I guess that's something that a lot of these children are not getting that either, are they? All these things that we take, as you said, we take for granted. We want to take them. We want our children to take those things for granted, then connecting in with when we don't have that. And, there's a lot of overdoing, but, I guess it's around, keeping that connection with, the moment, the environment, the community.
And it's so good for the child's developing brain. As I'm listening to you, the stuff that we poo-poo for children, like the doing stuff, the activity stuff, is needed to build the synapses of the brain and to allow the brain to grow and develop, to be a thinking brain, a loving brain, a brain that connects to others. I remember my eldest was tiny wee things in primary school, first year. So what's that, 5 years of age? And there's a couple of women sitting around. So this is in primary school, very first year of school. And they were debating getting a homework tutor. Now, I was blown out of the water,
right.
I thought, at 5 years of age. To which I said to them, yes, my boy's got a homework tutor. And they went, really? I said, yes, she's fabulous. They said, really? I said, yes. I said, she's very interested in active learning and kinetic learning. And they said, really? So where'd you get her? And I said, it's me. And I said, pardon?
Yeah.
I said, it's me. We go out in the back garden, we look for the footprints of the fairies in the dew, in the morning dew, and we collected cicada shells, and we would watch the snails and the leaves, and that's what fires the brain. If you want the brain to learn, connect it to what is around it, to people, to place, and to the joy and the beauty that we live in. And then the homework will come later. The homework will come later.
Yeah, that's right. It sure will. And the other thing that you touched on was, creating traditions. And so, when children are moved around, for example, they're not really, Christmas is probably always somewhere different with different people or maybe a negative experience. The blankets are going to hold a lot of that grounding for them, isn't it? With that, creating traditions is so important, and if they're missing that.
Absolutely. Yes, we've had some children come back to our house like 2, 3, 4, and 5 years later, and they have these wee grubby blankets that they're holding on to because they find it so important. And you're right, it comes with them, and that sense of identity comes with them. I'm a great believer in ritual and rite of passage, by the way. I don't know if it's my Celtic upbringing, because we Celts do love ritual and rite of passage. And we need to be careful not to lose that in children's lives. So simple routines, like certainly your bedtime routines, your bathroom time routines, but also bigger rituals and rites of passage that form identity. So, if going to school and leaving school and birthdays, and we had the most beautiful ritual I started with my boys when they were about, I think four-ish, maybe younger, three, certainly when they were verbal. And I would sit with them on the morning of their birthday and I'd say, okay, what privilege would you like for this birthday? So something like, kind of stay up a little bit later. And what responsibility would you like to take up for the family? So it would be maybe grand additions. And so every year they had to hold, they got some privileges, but they also had a duty. It was connected. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so, they were brought up with this beautiful sense of this is a rite of passage. As you grow older, you grow into who you are, and you also grow into connecting to others and having responsibility for yourself and the planet. I think the more family routines and rituals, the better. Beautiful. I get very, very good.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, I just facilitated a blessing way for a client on Saturday, which was beautiful, a beautiful ritual for her. She's about to give birth in the next couple of weeks. So, yeah, and it's amazing. A lot of people, most people there, it was quite a big group, probably about 30 or more, had never been to anything like that before. So, and they were all just couldn't believe how powerful it was, and really everyone basically stepping up to support, you know, this pregnant woman. And I guess, you know, with the children that you work with, it starts way back before, you know, their birth, that, you know, that, you know, not being supported, and back to the women, the carers, as you said earlier. Because you work quite a bit with women from traumatic situations too. So what sort of work do you do with them? Do they make blankets too?
Yes, we've just finished the most beautiful group. One of my clinicians finished the most beautiful group with a mother and her four sons and one daughter, mother of five children who escaped a very, very, very violent man, very, very scary man. And so they came to Cara House, and they did blankets. They did blankets together, and how they reconnected to each other as a family who lives without violence. So we do lots of those, blankets like that. And then also, again, for women to individual survivors of violence and trauma to find that self again, which violence tries to crush. And I say tries to crush because it always is very humbling for me to see the strength of some people have come through trauma. It's absolutely beautiful. So again, those are rites of passages. Those are celebrations. And people tend to associate the word celebration with abuse and trauma. But we do a lot of that.
A rite of passage is facilitating and celebrating the letting go of the old and welcoming the new, isn't it? The transformation from one part of your life to the next. So it's when you start looking at it like that, it's very appropriate to mark, you know, the end of one identity and one part of your life and start to celebrate as you step in, allow yourself to step into the next part of your life and identity and everything that comes with that.
Absolutely.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, and so tell us more about, you've got your, I want to talk about your charity that you've set up. You've put a lot of time and energy putting this beautiful charity. So hopefully people who are listening can learn something to become more aware as parents and helping others around them, but also, you know, how they can actually support your charity that's doing this amazing work with these women and children and families.
Yeah, that would be lovely, Tara. I am the official setting up of it started about 2.5 years ago, and that was looking at all the legal frameworks and the funding framework. So I had to get that all up and running. But the official launch of it was the Saturday in May? 2nd of May? 2nd of May? Just this year, so just about a month ago. We had the beautiful inaugural launch of the charity. And I have established it solely to run groups, for children, young people, and families who've been, again, affected by abuse and violence, and particularly neglect, because we find in our stats in New South Wales, New South Wales is one of the highest in having children who have been subjected to neglect, which is often a result of parents who are abusing drugs and alcohol. So with a little bit of money in the coffers, we can start running our first group, and of course our first group is going to be Wrapped in Angels, for a group of children who have suffered from neglect and have been removed from their families. And I've got different group work programs. So there's Wrapped in Angels, there's one called Two Trees, where we work with children who've been fostered or adopted so they can start to look at their identity of belonging to two family trees. So that's their birth family tree and then their foster or adoptive family tree. I've got group work programs I've written around sensory integration, because children who are traumatized often have a lot of sensory and motor difficulties, and particularly children have been physically abused. So I've got that's another program. I've got a lovely one called a Harmony Tree program, and that's about for women and children escaping domestic violence to repair the relationship. Because again, violence and a violent partner often tries to sever the relationship between women and children. So I've developed a group work program for that. Oh, we've got singing programs, we've got dancing programs. So all the group work programs are written, and we're just slowly building up funding. We've only started, so we don't have a lot of money in the pot, but we've enough to run our first group. And they're all facilitated by trained trauma therapists. So we all know the effects of trauma. We know how to work with the effects of trauma. And because we know that trauma is very much housed in the body, that's why our groups are based on movement and senses. Because we work with the body and the senses to release that story of trauma. Yeah, so that's my charity.
Yeah, and so what's the website for the charity?
So
the website,
Yes, it has. So it's caracare.org.au.
Caracare.org.au. And you can just donate the money there to help facilitate more groups.
So
the other interesting thing there is the two things. One was when you were talking about the branches, like the two, you know, the foster care family and the birth family, something like that would also, I imagine, be very helpful just with parents that have, you know, when they've got the split family and, you know, obviously not looking at the degree of trauma that you're talking about with the children that you work with, but there's a bit of a healing and needs to happen for when families break up, and something like that would, I imagine, would be very useful. Something that, you know, people that are just maybe trying to make the best out of their situation with a split family could do something like that, you know, tap the child. How would you see that working if someone wanted to just do something at home as a, you know, something to support their, you know, their little family, what's going on?
Yeah. So again, it's giving voice to the actual experience that children are going through. I've noticed a lot of adults are scared of speaking to children about very difficult issues because they're worried that it'll upset them, which I think is a beautiful ethic, not to upset a child. But I certainly know from my experience that children's imaginations are worse than the reality. So they imagine all types of, you know, terrible stuff. If we sit and talk to children and go, this is the reality, you know, particularly if you're living in different households. So let's talk about the different households. Who lives in one? Who lives in the other? Reasons why parents had to split, if it's within reason. Everything has to be developmentally appropriate, how you tell children. So that's just a given. So you can developmentally, appropriately tell children, you know, some of the facts that can help them make sense of it. And from that, really talk about the two different stories, because each household will have different ways of being. There's different rules. You know, you have to negotiate simple things from bedtimes to mealtimes, even relationship rules and how people communicate. If we don't have these conversations with children, how are they meant to negotiate? Really two different ways of being. I think it's extremely important. Right. That's the other thing I said to my boys. We will talk everything out in this family, and you will not leave the dining table until, you know, we've talked it out. And so some of our conversations have been quite robust over the years. And when people come to visit, how robust our conversations are. Because I go, if you can't talk about it around the dining room table, why are you doing it?
That's a good way to put it. You know what's interesting, Mary Jo, is that every interview that I've done, the dining room table comes up every time as just a key important factor of, you know, healthy relationship. Oh, every topic that we've talked about, the dining room table comes up as an important factor in there. And there it is again.
There we go. And we have this ritual at home where we set the table and we dress it. And because the boys are up a bit now, whoever cooks, the other two do the setting and the clearing. We do a blessing over the food. We don't do a religious prayer because the three of us have different kind of spiritual belief systems. In the one household, that was other interesting thing. I allowed my children to follow their own spiritual belief systems. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day. And so what we do is to thank for the food, to thank for the day. Fascinating, Tara, no matter who comes to our household. Now, I'm talking about teenage boys. I had teenage boys, and now I've got boys 21 to 18. when their friends sat at the table, they joined. My boy didn't, you know, say, "Oh, no, Mom, I'm not doing that." They'll go to greater beings and all who are listening, may we be thankful for. And their friends would just come along with it and would say, "This is the ritual in the family around the dining room table." We have thrashed so much out around the dining room table. That's a very, very important ritual.
No, I was just going to say, I find that children that don't do that at their house, when that, because, you know, the teenage, my daughter's 16, that when they come to my house and I make them do that, I'm like, oh, I don't even, I just say, hey, here's a cutlery, put that out, you do this, you do that. They love it. They really love, because it comes back to that sense of belonging which we started with.
That's exactly right. And we were sitting around the table, I don't know, last year, whatever, so by that stage, Conda was 18 and Kayla was 20. We were thrashing something out. And one of their friends were there, and I said, "Well, you know, well, what do you say to your parents about this stuff?" And this boy looked at me and went, "I don't talk to my parents." I said, "Pardon?" And Connor, my youngest friend, went, "Ma, don't you get it?" I went, "No, darling." He said, "Ma, nobody talks to their children like you do." It was just a phenomenon for his group of friends that you dare talk to your mother. And I mean everything, Tara. I said to my boys, everything. I want to hear, not hear it all. I don't mean their private stuff. I don't mean that. I mean just the stuff of life. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, the table's a perfect place for it, that's for sure.
Yeah,
yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, the importance of eating together at the table has come up in every conversation, and I do see how much people love it when they come to our house, when they don't have that at home, and often they also aren't talking to their parents much. And again, that's something that the children that you're working with, you know, have missed out on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And including ordinary argy-bargy, because when I worked, I only worked in my children's school hours. So when they're in primary school, I'd make sure I left them to school and I'd pick them up, and I think they only had one day in after-school care. And as I went to grammar school, I extended my hours a little bit, but not too much. And somebody said to me, "What's the point for the teenagers? You know, when they come home, they're just going to grunt at you and slam the door in your face." And I said, "Correct." And this person said, "What?" And I said, "It's going to be my face. They slam the door in. It's going to be me they're grumpy to. It's going to be me they're swearing at, because I'm going to be present." And I think we forget that about our teenagers. They really, our teenagers need us to be present. Now, it can be quite obnoxious. You know? And there's argy-bargy. I'm not going to pretend that we're a perfect family. We're not. We've had so much argy-bargy. But my boys don't go home to an empty house. Or a mother who's, you know, full of alcohol or so off her face in drugs, or father, you know, who's disappeared. There is someone to argue with, to find your identity through. And that's our job, particularly as parents of teenagers. Our job is, you know, to put up with the grumpy,
when
socks off.
Yeah, when my eldest, was about six, I never forget it. Stuck in my mind, ingrained on my mind, in the car park at school. And my oldest was just starting school, and I remember a mother saying, "Teenagers are easy. You just have to be present all the time." I'll never forget her saying that. Yeah.
And
so the hard part being present.
The hard part being, it is, because it's very, very hard to be present when somebody tells you, "Well, we're terrible, no, you're terrible, you're wicked, you're evil, you're awful." "I know, son. You don't understand me." "I know, son. You know, you're just doing this to ruin my life." "I know." You just have to accept all of that and go, "I know." Because I think it's just too scary not to be there for our teenagers. I just think it's too vulnerable.
Especially with the internet, with all the online stuff, they need, often my daughter will come and say, "Oh, this has happened and what do I think?" And I'll help her navigate a situation. But you can see that on the other end, often children haven't got someone helping them to navigate the situation, and things blow up easily there. So, you know, coming back again to the children that you work with, you know, often they probably don't have someone to help them navigate the situations that they're in, and someone to confide in.
And then when they don't, because they've got no boundaries, and plus the whole turmoil of trauma, they act out their story in their behavior. So when you are scared and bewildered and frightened and you have been abused, you don't tend to sit down in front of a therapist and say, may I deconstruct, you know, the identity of my abused childhood. That's not what they tend to do. They tend to get into trouble. And then they get punished. And then the cycle keeps going. And then they get this label of a troublemaker or ODD, HDD, X, Y, and a ZD. And I go, these children aren't that. They're traumatized. Look behind the behavior to the story they're telling us.
Yeah, but that's where also, like, a lot of the work that you're doing with them is through, you know, the art therapy, the making the angel blanket. So there's, you know, they're wanting to communicate in other ways aside from sitting and talking, aren't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I very rarely sit, talk to child.
So what? How does, tell us a bit about how that sort of works, say the art therapy or... I mean, I just know it's so healthy to sit around and, you know, make something together as well. But what do you think is, you know, how does that facilitate their healing and their communicating what they need?
On the simpler plane, it's the fact that when they're active, they don't feel so under the microscope, so they can talk freer. So that would be one level. When you're doing something, you can almost get into that lovely, just kind of chat-type flow. But then when you go into the deeper level, the fact that we know that accessing traumatic memories isn't as straightforward as just recalling what you did yesterday because of the whole flooding of the adrenal system. And so I think a lot of memories that stay in there or can't find a verbal voice come out when you're just allowed to express it through the symbolic movement of play or art, and I think it's a great symbolic portal into looking at what happens to children. And then on another level again, I do believe in like memory being held and throughout the body physically, because we know about the whole flow of the neuropeptides that, you know, go through the body. And so again, when you're moving through anything, through dance, through play and art therapy, because there's a little movement in that, I think it also locks the type of the chemical memory, to put a very simplistic term on it, as well. So I think art and play therapy work at all those levels. Yeah. And it's important. I think it's important to have fun when your life's pretty tough. I think it's extremely important to have a different experience of yourself other than the depressed one or the angry one or the sad one or the despairing one. You can go, whoops, and here's the other one who can have fun and who can paint and who can use glitter and so on. An alternative story to a problem-saturated story can also, you know, come out of those experiences.
Yeah, that's right. And if we haven't had those experiences imprinted, you know, into us and onto our being and into our mind and our heart, then it's almost a relearning and a rediscovering of that part of yourself, I imagine.
We must honour the wisdom of play. And I even outside of my professional life, it's one of my bugbears when I hear adults in my personal life that kind of poo-pooing play, or they're just playing. I'm going, oh my goodness, play is the greatest universe on the planet, and it's essential for so much of children's development, you know, social, physical development, and also it's just a place of fun. And I think it's okay to have fun in this world. We offer that to children who've been traumatized.
And it sounds amazing. So, so your website is carahouse.com.au, and do people need a referral? A referral to come to see you, or they can just contact you directly?
They can contact directly as well, yeah.
Caracare.org.au for the charity to donate some money towards, funding these wonderful groups that you do for people. And my other question would be as well, like, have you got some advice for people if they feel like they know, okay, so if they're in a situation themselves that they need to reach out, or if they know someone that they feel like needs some help reaching out. Have you got advice for those sort of people? So say you know someone, you know, what's the first step for people when they realize that they really do need to get some help if they're in an abusive situation or something like that?
I would take a big, deep breath on someone you trust. Start there.
Big someone you trust.
Find someone you trust. Absolutely. Speak it out. If you don't feel it is anybody, there are helplines. There are domestic violence helplines, child protection helplines, and different NGOs have their own helplines. But you must take a big, deep breath and make the first move and find someone to speak to. It's simple, but it's the most difficult thing. It's an interesting. Once you do that part, while the rest will be difficult, that is the most difficult one, is the first stepping forward and saying, I need help. And it's okay to say, I need help.
And I guess that's part of bringing the conversation of parenting and motherhood and everything that we go through as families, bring it to the table so that hopefully we, you know, more and more people speak out earlier when they need help rather than later.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for giving us your time. It's been very insightful.
Not at all, Tara. Thank you.
On many, many levels.
Giving me the time to chat to you.
It's an absolute pleasure. And I'll put all the details on the website as well so people can follow through with what you do. It's been insightful in what you do with the families that you work with, as well as how, you know, we can start to bring a few important things that we can bring into our everyday life, you know, to enrich our own lives and, you know, find that balance for ourselves where we started, you know, of holding, you know, strong, loving boundaries, but allowing flexibility and actually talking about things so that we can, you know, just become more evolved, I guess, as parents and mothers and in society on this level.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to talk to you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. I love what you do, and I...
thank you, Tara. Yeah,
I would just... Yeah, I really do love what you do. I really mean that sincerely. And I can just see how many people that you would help. And each one person that you help in a tiny way is going to have a ripple effect, you know, through the next, you know, the people that they come in contact with and the next generation to follow.
That's exactly right. Because someone said to me about a couple of weeks ago, why do you do this? It's such an overwhelming problem. And I say, but it would be worse if I wasn't present. All I have to do is be present. And the rest, the work will do itself. But to not be present to someone suffering,
This is the EWN Radio Network.